Hello, my name is John Cavanaugh. I am currently chairman of the Department of Physician Assistant Studies at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Today is February 21st, 2011. The recording that follows here was originally made in early 1976 by me while I was a student in the Physician Associate Program at Yale University. In the recording, I interview Ann Bliss, who was a pioneer of the physician assistant profession and was one of the founders of the Physician Associate Program at Yale University in 1970. In the recording, Ann talks about some of the personalities involved in the early days of the program and also discusses some issues that were current to the PA profession in the mid-1970s. This recording is my personal property. All rights are reserved. It may not be used in part or whole or reproduced without my permission.
There we go.
Okay. Good
enough. Now, what I'd like to know is, whose bright idea was it to have a PA program here at Yale? And how was that idea realized?
Well, that was Jack Cole's idea. Okay. And it was not exactly, a central idea for him. It was part, of his trauma program. And as you well know, that was multidisciplinary. And so he wanted to have transportation, law, behavioral science, and a manpower component. And his manpower component was the surgical assistant, as it was originally termed. It became very apparent after Paul came from the Duke program, and as a type A primary care physician's associate type of person, that that's the kind of curriculum we were going to have here. And Dr. Cole was very generous, I think, in his ability to allow the thing to move out of trauma in its focus and out of surgery in its specialty orientation and to call it a primary care, physician's associate. Mm-hmm. This also sort of coincided with the national movement, which was to take the physician's assistant term away and make it an associate, which implied more of a collegial thing and seemed to capture everybody's satisfaction more accurately, the notion of high level of independent clinical judgment. And then all at about that time, also with the beginning of the talk of having a certification exam, with the National Medical Examiners, and that's where they got into the assistant to the primary care physician. So it became very apparent that physician assistants were really going to be very broad, broadly trained for a very broad role. So I don't know how bright an idea that, it wasn't much, as we now know the PA program, as we now know the PA concept, that was not Dr. Cole's original idea. He was only concerned about a high level technical assistant who could, at the hospital door, probably in the emergency room, provide a very high level of trauma care.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you go about doing this here at Yale?
What, the whole trauma program?
Well, the PA program, I have some idea. Who?
Well, Dr. Cole is very much of a delegator. The first thing he did was to hire Paul in terms of having a surgical assistant program. He hired Paul as a Duke PA, which is interesting because given the fact that Dr. Cole had been given money to have a manpower program which was very narrow in its focus on trauma and on a surgical assistant, he hired a type A Duke trained physician's assistant or associate. And it was, I think, and then he really said to Paul, now, you come up with a curriculum. You decide what it is you want to do. And of course, Paul was championing it a bit. Paul had worked after Duke at the University of Vermont doing some metabolic research, but he'd been primarily seduced up there by the promise that they would have a PA program, type A, Duke type, two-year program eventually at the University of Vermont. Well, whoever hired him up there was never able to bring it off. They could never carry through the institutional commitment and resolve the institutional politics about it. So Paul was brought down here to start a PA program here, And Dr. Cole really said, you know, it's yours, do it. And of course, that's the way he functioned, in fact, with all of us. And so Paul came up really with a Duke model of a curriculum. Another thing that tended to foster that was that Paul, being a member of that one of those early Duke classes, was beginning at that time to be very influential nationally. All those early Duke people were very highly sought to teach in programs, and run for organizational office and to do a lot of organizational work. So he was in touch with a lot of other people. And the whole movement was moving toward replicating the Duke model, which is exactly what he did here. And he had enough delegation and authority from Dr. Cole invested in him to be able to carry it off.
And who was part of the original staff?
In terms of the PA,
yeah,
or the so-called surgical assistant thing?
Yeah.
Paul was. Very soon after he arrived, maybe within 3 months or so, the Sapphers came on as co-directors of the trauma program, and they became likewise co-directors of the surgical assistant program.
Mm-hmm.
And I also was added to that original staff. I'm not really sure I had a title, but I was a research associate at the time.
Now, had you been with the trauma program before then?
I was the first person that Jack Cole hired under his trauma program.
Mm-hmm. So you've been now?
Since, that was January of 1970. He hired Paul in about March of 70, and the Sadlers came that summer of 70.
Mm-hmm.
And the first PA class started January 1, 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a kind of to-do about the whole thing, because and that was largely Paul's doing. The Sadlers would be happier to wait and start a program the following September of 71.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was just, I think, partly because he was burned by the Vermont experience. He was afraid, you know, if we just let this thing go another 6 months, maybe the thing will evaporate on him. Paul had everything cranked up and he wanted to go, so he kind of, and I hope you'll deal with this discreetly, we kind of went around the Sadlers and went to Dr.
Mm-hmm.
Cole and said, look, damn it all, I'm ready to go. Dr. Cole said, you should go. So he kind of called the Sadlers in and said, you know, I realize you've only been here. This was like in November, so I realize you've only been here maybe 3 or 4 months trying to lay the land. But you've got Paul, he is ready to go. And I really think he probably is ready to go. So get with it and start a small class in January. And they said, well, what about September? We'll have to start another class then, too. Dr. Cole shook his head and said, yes, that's right. So that's how Paul got his class. And that explains why there was that initial overlap.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, in a way, I must admire Paul for being willing to undertake having, you know, two classes going. Because there was overlap in the didactic. At least now, you know, you get the didactic 9 months done, and then you start clerkship. Then there's even a 3-month breather between the next didactic, before you have to deal with the next didactic.
Mm-hmm.
He had overlap because they were only, I guess in September, it was just about right from January to September.
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't, there was just a little tiny bit of overlap, but it was a real scramble because there was no rest in between,
mm-hmm.
and there was no time really to have that interval where you could just concentrate wholly on the clinical settings, and of course that was a whole new thing, getting that set up and expanded.
It would be easier if I had more of a structure.
Yeah.
Paul had given us some idea of what it works. Mm-hmm.
Let's see, we've covered about how that program got started and who started it. And
well, what about things like funding?
Well, originally, of course, this was, as I say, part of the trauma program. The trauma program was one of the last big private foundation grants in the old halcyon days of private funding.
Mm-hmm.
In 1969, with the Tax Reform Act, which took about a year or two to get interpreted and enforced, in late 1969, was actually when Dr. Cole got his $2 million grant from the Commonwealth Foundation. Dr. Cole tells a story which I'm afraid is probably somewhat apocryphal, but it is sort of typical of what old-fashioned funding used to be. Dr. Cole went down to the Harkness Mansion on the corner of 72nd Fifth Avenue in New York City, talked to Quig Newton, who's an old Yale alumnus, but a very astute gentleman. And Dr. Cole described sitting in Mr. Newton's office on a wintry day, sipping sherry in front of a fire, talking to him about his vision of mounting his multidisciplinary attack on trauma. And Mr. Newton said, but $700,000 is not enough money to do that. Supposing I have you go into the next room where there's a desk and paper and work on the budget some more, I'll come back in half an hour. And so Dr. Cole remedied the budget to some extent and then talked about needing a new, having some concerns about needing his new laboratory of obstetrics and gynecology and surgery, the LOGES building. So I guess Mr. Newton looked at the request for $1 million for the program and said, well, how'd you like it if we matched it for $1 million for the new building?
Oh, boy.
And so that was the reason for the $2 million grant. Mm-hmm. $1 million of it for program, $1 million of it for the building. Mr. Newton and the Commonwealth Fund gave the $2 million to Dr. Cole and said, now we probably think you'll have trouble spending $1 million on program in anything less than 3 years. And you probably will have a hard time having it last any longer than 5 years, but you can do either. And you probably will have a hard time having it last any longer than 5 years, but you can do either. All we request of you in the annual report, and the great change in the Tax Reform Act is that you cannot give money all that to people anymore. It all has to be line item budget. You have to specify exactly what you want the money for and exactly who's going to do it and exactly what the program will be. If under present day private philanthropy, the minute the surgical assistant program wanted to become a physician associate program, the funding would have come to a screaming halt. A proposal would probably have to have been resubmitted and reapproved and the whole, the whole thing. So now about 2 or maybe 3 years into the program, and Paul could certainly be more helpful on this, fairly early in the program, HEW, Office of Special Programs, had just a bundle of money for PA programs, and that was the federal government's initial commitment to the experiment, the PA experiment. Macy Foundation, Commonwealth Fund, Carnegie, and Rockefeller had all funded little spots of PA programs around the country. Federal government, and this is typical of the role of private philanthropy. It sets up something that then the federal government can take over and really put some money into, which is exactly what happened. So requests for proposal went out, RFPs for programs either established or wishing to establish PA programs along the Type A model, and also the medics programs came under this funding. And that funding obtains today, that continues, and on a continuing basis every year through 1977. So about 2 or 3 years into the physician's assistant program here at Yale, the funding moved off of Commonwealth funding and into HEW.
Could you talk a little bit about what the history, the course of the program has been here in relation to the Yale Corporation and the schools, the medicine and nursing?
Well, I think the Yale Corporation hasn't really had much concern about the program until recently, when it was decided to charge tuition. Yale always has a number of programs in the works, which are experimental and which are totally funded from the outside, which require very little, if any, institutional commitment. And in fact, given the old federal funding with high levels of overhead provided, these experimental programs often bring money into the institution. So a program like this would never come to the corporation's attention, never really came to downtown's attention until about 3 years ago. Because we were so well funded, we were allowed to just sort of grow like Topsy and go about our business. Now, about 3 or 4 years ago, I guess co-education started at Yale about 5 or 6 years ago. About 3 or 4 years ago, Yale began to rethink the opportunities for its female undergraduates, for graduate school and for professional preparation. And they've always looked at this program with some interest as a potential resource for undergraduate males and females who wish it as an alternative to medical school or who have to consider it as an alternative to medical school. So that 2 years ago, Provost, then Charles Taylor, convened a committee here at the medical school, which had medical school, nursing school, and physician's assistant, and hospital administrator representation on it, to look at the PA program with a number of options in mind. Could it become a master's program in the School of Medicine, perhaps in the School of Public Health? Could it become a certificate program? Could there be a core curriculum shared with the School of Nursing? Could the program move into the School of Nursing and become a School of Nursing program for non-nurse women and men? Or should the program be done away with altogether? Or perhaps might the Yale New Haven Medical Center take it over as a med center program? And of course there was always being a little side issue here, might it be handed off to Quinnipiac? Because one of the original things, which I forgot to mention, was that when Dr. Cole originally thought about a surgical assistant program, and he had chatted some with Dr. Goldenberg about this, they had made some preliminary negotiations with Quinnipiac to have the program, to have that be the academic affiliation for the surgical assistant program. Paul got here, took one look at Quinnipiac and said, "Over my dead body," and was able really to negotiate the beginning of the loose affiliation with Yale. Mm-hmm. He said there was no way that academically the thing could really be tied to Quinnipiac. So Selig Senate Committee convened for a whole year, met, invited testimony, met and wrangled. School of Nursing feeling very threatened. The Seligson Committee final report, and probably, as I best remember it, and you can probably either get a copy of it if you don't already have a copy and review it. But in general, as I remember it, they said, well, the program should probably be continued, at least on an experimental basis. So they took that option of removing the program. They didn't go for that option. Handing it over to Quinnipiac or Yale New Haven Medical Center was out. The program should probably stay as an experimental program in the School of Medicine. School of Nursing, it was probably not feasible to have it taken over by the School of Nursing. There was probably no way yet to really bring it in as a master's program. However, and that was really mostly because of the resistance on the part of the school admission. They really just said it's too experimental, and they warned Yale against adopting it as a master program. The school medicine said in due time, we think that it would be worth having a relook. So that was one of the recommendations we saw in a couple of years, relook at the possibility of a master's degree. The possibility of charging tuition may or may not have been mentioned in that. It was just really a matter in terms of the findings of all systems, but continue as you are. There's a bit of a clinker in the report in that as it was submitted to Crosstown, Charlie Taylor, I think he was still provost. I'm not entirely sure whether Hannah Holborn Gray had come in as provost to replace him or not. At any rate, the slides in the report were submitted to Crosstown. The very last minute, without anyone else on the committee's knowledge, the School of Nursing submitted a minority report, which was attached to the Seligson report, saying that Yale should be, in effect, ashamed of itself for having what was essentially a vocational program in its academically respectable midst. The absolute lack of a requirement for a bachelor's degree was really disgraceful. The lack of any kind of university screening of the applicants, the program screening of the applicants, was really something that very suspect, and that the lack of academic rigor in the program and the heavy clinical emphasis, which was all right given the fact they were preparing technicians and not academicians, really seemed to place the program more appropriately outside of the university, perhaps at a place like Quinnipiac. But in any case, they really wanted to go on record as saying very strongly that they felt that the program, regardless of its primary care, service relevance, whatever, belonged elsewhere academically. The way they did it kind of turned off any support they might have had from the committee because of the way they did it. Absolutely wrong. The committee, even those members of the committee who might have had some sympathy with the point they were making, had absolutely no sympathy with the way they kind of slipped the minority report on as an addendum to the basic report. So I don't think it did the cause very much good. Right from the beginning, the School of Nursing has been understandably wary of the PA program. There's been some joint socializing on a formal basis, and joint sherry hours and that kind of thing. Our students, mm-hmm. your students kind of thing. Some joint faculty and administration, let's get to know one another. Paul's been able to arrange some taking of most of the PA classes. We haven't really been able to find many of the nursing courses that we could plug into, mostly because of the way they're stretched out. And there have been some real curricular obstacles to somehow sharing more of the courses, although that has loomed as a problem in the School of Medicine from the faculty who are called upon on Monday to lecture the PA students, and on Wednesday to lecture to the School of Nursing, and they say, is there some way I could just do it once on Thursdays and not have to do it twice? So with that kind of pressure, there is a continuing sort of thing in the School of Medicine to say, look, we really ought to get together on this, or our faculty will not be available to the School of Nursing, and the School of Nursing is not reacting very favorably to that. So one of the things that you have in an academic center like this is that when you want, if you're in the School of Nursing and you want a psychologist on the faculty to come lecture to you, you don't have to pay him. You just get him to come. Just as my own, I'm on the faculty surgery and I don't get reimbursed for my course in psychodynamics. Mm-hmm. So if the School of Nursing is told by the medical school faculty, you know, we simply cannot teach both, then the School of Nursing has an alternative but to hire outside lecturers, and then they're going to begin paying, and that gets very expensive. So the having, really, in the eyes of the medical school faculty, duplicative didactic material is proving, at this point, to be somewhat of a burden and a challenge to the School of Nursing. Mm-hmm. But that's still very spotty.
How's it going? I have to wait for the tape. Got about 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. What? Let's see.
Now, recently, in terms of the relationship of the program to the Yale, there's been an interesting development, which I think I've talked to you about before. About a year or so ago, a lot of pressure from ATW. They convened all the deans of the schools of medicine in Washington and said, now if you fellows are going to provide primary care residencies, family practice residencies, and or nurse practitioner or physician associate programs to get at the national problem of primary care.
Mm-hmm.
Training a physician scientist is okay, and lead specialists and subspecialists is okay. You've really got to start turning out some people for primary care, and how you're going to do that is not our concern. However, as a carrot, we will make certain capitation rewards to you for your primary care efforts. Yale said you will not dictate to us, and what if we tell you to take your money and you know what you can do with it? So, ATW and some of the architects of some of the health insurance bills like Kennedy have made it very clear that a school like Yale will be cut off without a cent of federal money to its medical school if it doesn't get the primary care. The dean of the School of Medicine and with Tina Brewster's support, and I assume the support of the corporation, have said absolutely under no circumstances are we going to undertake a primary care or a family practice residency. So finally, the Physicians Associate Program looms as the only link, primary care link. So now all of a sudden, in Kingman and Brewster's annual report last year, you devote several pages to, as a lawyer and as a president, to the issue of the federal government attempting to coerce private institutions. Mm-hmm. That's around this whole issue of primary care. The the medical school has recently written an editorial in the Yale Medicine, which is the alumnus magazine for Yale School of Medicine, talking again about, all right, primary care is a problem. We don't deny that it's a problem. Our argument is with those solutions to that problem, which are being proffered throughout the land. We believe that a school like Yale School of Medicine should do what it does best, which is its true search for truth, beauty, and goodness in exactly that order.
Mm-hmm.
And we will continue to churn out physician scientists and first-class specialists. However, we do believe that primary care belongs to nurse practitioners and physician associates, and we do have a physician associate program. And in the next 5 pages of that alumnus magazine, devoted to the PA program. A nice. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Ask them for it. Mm-hmm. Yale Medicine, it's like, I think they're fall issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just tie Brewster's annual report and Yale Medicine, both the dean's editorial and that article, and you get the message of an increased interest in, and at least for the time being, a commitment to the physician associate program. Now, how that will all turn out in 1977 when the funding for PA programs dries up, that was never intended to be an add-in finitum eternal experiment.
Mm-hmm.
As with all federal things, and the government's willing to support something for 7 to 10 years, and then if it has any worth, it will be adopted and institutionalized and paid for down at the local level. So the funding is due to run out in 77. Now, there may be an extension, so maybe we're talking about 78 or 80. But at some point, push will come to shove, a moment of truth, and will an institution like Yale make the necessary commitment of money to keep a PA program going? It costs about, here at Yale, about $9,000 a year per student. So it's about an $18,000 to $20,000 education. Now, is Yale going to pick up the difference between the $2,500 tuition it charges and the $9,000 or $10,000 a year that costs? It'll obviously go up in its tuition to some extent. It might go up to 5 or 6, which is the tuition for the rest of the university. But will it pick up the remaining 5? Will it be able to really go to the students and say, if you want this kind of PA education, you've got to pay $10,000 for it? That's what it costs us. You know, and maybe there's some way to scale the cost down to maybe 7 or 8. And then would one still go to the students and say, it's a very worthwhile education for 2 years and it costs $7,000, don't we? Now that's the future of the dilemma and the problem. In the meantime, I think the program has served the university very well and is in a reasonably strong position.
Well, what about federal funding and capitation to pick up the difference on the 10,000 to 2,500?
I don't know. I think that the federal government that might be one way they would extend, would be to say any and serve as a transitional period as a kind of an incentive to medical schools to pick up those PA programs. You might say to the medical school, we will make it worth your while to pick up those medical schools. And that's how the programs will be extended, rather than saying to the programs, we will directly fund you for X amount of time, another 3, another 5 years. So that would be a mechanism. On the other hand, they may cold turkey and say, absolutely no capitation unless a medical school has a family practice or a primary care residency. In which case, Now, Ken Winnicott, who has been in charge of all these funds, retires in 77, I think, or soon after, and he has been heard to say that he doesn't think there's any future for PAs. The federal strategy has been to leave the physicians associates under the saddle of nursing until nursing could and would shape up. And the federal strategy is to leave the PA under the nursing saddle until they're sufficiently sure that nursing is going to get themselves together to do primary care.
Mm-hmm.
But basically the feds believe that the nurse is in fact the person best suited. And it would appear, and I think nursing has made it a rather magnificent catch-up in the last few years. Now, what would happen to PAs? But, the question for now is, what will you do to those PAs who have already been trained? They will have the option of sitting for the registered nurse exam or being admitted into nursing in some capacity, or maybe sitting for the AMA exam for the nurse practitioner certification.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a possibility to lodge ahead. I'm not necessarily saying that it's a probability, but it is a possibility. You might be interested to know how the PA movement ever began in the first place. You know, certainly the Duke program began when it does Duke on the Gene Stead in 65. Well, in 1958, Dr. Stead and Thelma Ingalls, a nurse, started the first nurse practitioner program at the master's level at Duke in internal medicine, and it was a medical nurse practitioner program. They had a whole floor of in patients in medicine, and the nurse practitioners really functioned as house officers. They even had it down to science, where the nurses kept track of the kinds of services they provided and billed the patients directly under nursing service for those services, and the patients were paying them. The MLM came down on three occasions and refused each time to accredit the program, not over any concern about the quality of the education, training, clinical supervision that those nurses were getting, but on the very premise of the program, which was that nurses would in any capacity be practicing any level of medicine. They said it was dangerous and it was inappropriate for nurses to be practicing any level of medicine. Well, they had to fulfill their commitment to their existing students. It took them an additional 2 years to wind down. And Stead was so mad. He said, that's it. The hell with nursing, you know. Thelma Ingalls, the irony goes on. Thelma Ingalls went to work for the Rockefeller Foundation and became a professional exile who did about 10 or 12 years in South America in Cali, Colombia, training nurse practitioners in the master program. Really a professional exile, unable within her own profession in this country to carry out her vision. And so Dr. Stead picked up the cudgel, turned to the returning ex-military corpsman, and started the PA program. So it was nursing's default in the beginning. And it wasn't just Stead and Ingalls, because in 1960, Ernest Howard, who was then AMA president, stood up and said, he's had appointments. He neglected to tell the ANA about this, that there were some 50,000 office nurses in this country, and wouldn't it be a boon if they could be made into physician's assistants? The physician would teach them how to do history and physical, Well, the ANA came out of their hives within hours saying, I think quite correctly, but not very nicely, that the ANA had no right to speak unilaterally for another profession, that the ANA would speak for another profession, and that the ANA personally could not subscribe on behalf of their constituency to the appropriation of nurses or nursing by medicine, and that medicine was not going to rob Peter to pay Paul, and that was it, in the exact language. Well, I'll tell you, you know, hell hath no fury like that of a woman scorned, and Ernest Howard just, you know, retreated into his AMA and licked his wounds for a long time. But, so that nursing had, you know, not only a demonstration opportunity in the Duke experiment, but had a very public forum for this notion of having nurses, at least some nurses, be physician's assistants. And in both instances, it got organizationally squashed, in one instance by the MLM and in the other instance by the AMA. So it was nursing's default originally. And the feds say that it was the most, that nursing is the most appropriate thing. Mm-hmm. And that they're going to forgive nursing if the original default is nursing is able and willing to catch up. And now there are hundreds, I mean, I think this is important. If one contrasts the number of programs, there are 48 AMA accredited programs and nearly half of those in the genetics programs, which are kind of on their way out.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got roughly 40 type A solid physician assistant programs, or physician assistant programs. There are 100 certificate nurse practitioner programs and 54 master's clinician programs. There are now, in the 10 years that we've had PA programs, there are some 2,000 PAs. In the 5 years that nursing's been playing catch-up, there are 4,000 nurse practitioners. So they have twice the number of graduates that the PAs do, and they have three times the number of groups or programs.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, what's the quality of practitioners? What's the quality?
Of the two practitioners?
Yeah, of PAs, recruiters, practitioners.
I don't, in terms of their functioning, I don't see much difference. And I think that those differences probably wash out after a year in a setting. And if I were going to a primary care setting where there's a nurse practitioner and a physician's associate, I would anticipate, and they both worked there at least a year, I would anticipate that either one of them could do thorough history and physical and a clinical diagnosis and depending on what I had, I had some level of treatment, including the prescription and follow-up. I would expect both of them to tend to my psychosocial needs and to do health teaching and counseling with me. And I absolutely make no differentiation. I think that they get to where they get to that function by different reasons. And I will say that I think that the physician's associates in general, but that's only in general, because the certificate nurse practitioners are trained predominantly by physician preceptorship. That's the way physician's associates are. So that if you're matching, I would match. Now, if you want me to do another level of matching, which is the certificate versus the master's nurse clinician with a PA, I would say the PAs and the certificate trained nurses, nurse practitioners, are much more alike in their level of clinical judgment, in their basic science background, and in their ability to perform certain medical tasks, such as lumbar punctures, suturing, that sort of thing. I think that if you're going to compare a physician's associate with a master's nurse clinician, that the master's nurse clinician is woefully lacking in her science base, the level of clinical medicine, and in her clinical tasks. And the reason for that is that a master's clinician receives about 12 hours a week of clinical training in his first year, perhaps, and 4 hours a week of clinical contact in his second year because of her research thesis.
Mm-hmm.
And you just simply cannot make a good clinician of any kind at that level. My own experience with good nurse practitioner programs, as well as in the clinical anesthesia and PA program, is that you need 1 year, at least 1 year, of 30 hours of clinical contact a week to make any kind of clinician.
Mm.
But again, I think that if you took a master's clinician, put her in a setting, and she were preceptor, you could get her up to that after a year, and you could get her up to the same level as her first certificate and her physician's associate colleagues.
Okay. Another issue that has been raised, and I think you mentioned it three more times. I just read recently that shortly after World War II, there was a move to take the corpsmen and turn them into practical nurses. It failed because the author of this article felt it failed because that at that time they just weren't ready to. The second move wasn't such that a number of men could go into what was viewed as particularly a women's profession. Now, you mentioned earlier that if this whole PA thing doesn't go, as if I think it won't, and appear to be important in nursing, do you think the time of the session would change so that that men will continue to go into this profession?
I'm afraid that nursing will always be a sex-friendly profession because the very name nursing means to nourish at the breast. 2% of all nurses now are men, and that's the amount of progress they've been able to make in that field. What I would anticipate if the PA thing closed down and the offer were made by nursing to open up for those people who want to be nurses, I think that even the female PAs would have a very difficult time identifying themselves as nurses. Many of our students, female students, choose the position because it is a clear alternative to nursing. We likewise do not have many, and we thought we would have many, nurses applying to become physician associates. I think that there's just something professionally kind of separate about the two professions, even though, as I say, they function pretty much very similarly. You certainly see this on the salary differential, which is anywhere from $3,000 to $4,000. PAs getting $3,000 to $4,000 more than a nurse practitioner, regardless of whether that physician's associate is a male or a female. It doesn't seem to be the issue of female versus male. The other thing that's very interesting, of course, is that the ratio of PAs now today by graduates as of 1976 is 70 male, 30 female, having started really from almost 100% male just 10 years ago. And the ratio in nursing, of course, is 98.2. Now, I do think that the federal government may provide for a number of PAs, given this mail issue, because I really think that is, or, I shouldn't say that, I guess, just given the issue, there's a lot of PAs, regardless whether males or females, who don't want to be identified as nurses. They bought into the physicians associate thing, and that's what they want to be. I think federal government may just allow for the continued practice of any PA who was ever trained in one of their experimental programs. Although they may open nursing to those who want to make sure they have a, you know, be part of a larger professional group and have some organization of which they are a constituent member.
And what are the implications for a mid-level primary care practice of the whole scheme if it's, quote, female-dominated, unquote? Is there any implication there?
Well, there's some of those movements within the medical profession which offset that. Family practice may be considered a mid-level health practitioner. Family practice physician may be considered. And some of the primary care physicians may likewise be considered kind of an intermediate level health worker. Perger at Tufts, P-R-O-G-E-R, and Rosinski, I'm not sure where he is, as well as Dr. Silver out in Denver, have all published papers on their notion of where medicine ought to go. And that is that there would be two levels of physician. Physician scientist at the top level, the specialist and subspecialist at the middle level, and the general practitioner, family practitioner, at the sort of entering level.
Mm-hmm.
And they would all take different periods of time to get to. Proger and Rosinski are talking about that kind of a model for medicine. Silver has advocates what Proger and Rosinski advocate, but he carries it a step further and says the primary care physician, the general practice physician, so you see, the other escape route, should medicine open itself up, would be for medicine to say, all right, you nurse practitioners and you physicians associates who want to be called grade one general practitioner physicians will be let in, physicians. That's a possibility, although I don't know. Medicine is even more rigid in its categorization than in its turf and nursing and these are the voices in the wilderness. Now, if we have a national health insurance scheme, which in fact goes beyond merely providing adequate reimbursement for services, but which really serves to curb cost by socializing medicine. If we ever have socialized medicine, it may well be that we will have three levels of practitioner and national medical schools and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it's off. That's another remote kind of avenue for. Now, another thing in terms of to get kind of get back, you know, you may be wondering how's all this fitting with the LPA program. Things that are really kind of special about the physician associate program is that Paul, of course, has been past president of the Academy of Physician Associates. The Sadlers have been national movers in the physician associate movement in the AMA accreditation thing in the National Board of Medical Examiners. Commission on certification, and then a variety of other things. And I'm not sure, I think Prince Sadler may have been one of the first presidents of the Academy of Physician Associate Programs.
Hmm.
So that you have here at Yale a kind of a nidus for the national movement, or have had, at least, and then of course the book Sadler said, and I believe. Continues to be heavily cited. There's a very good paper, a little torturous, in the Kansas Law Review written by Amina Kiffin, and he heavily cites the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a lot that's occurred in terms of the national movement.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with the San Luis Obispo International Foundation and myself, their work continues to see that kind of ripple effect. So that we have still a lot of organizational leadership within the program, plus some organizational discipleship outside the program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What has been your history?
Well, I was here, of course, when Paul came on board, and he and I shared a tiny little office together. And I was served primarily as a kind of a hot chicken soup during those early months, and just had a terrible time wondering how I was going to get this thing off the ground. I don't know if he remembers or has any gratitude for those days, but that's a really talented that tried his soul.
It wouldn't seem so right now.
Yeah, that's right. That's really something. And the office, actually, was so small. We had these two large standard size, old, dirty, gray steelcase desks. And the amount of pelvic injury we both sustained trying to just, you know, get out of the room, because through this about 8-inch opening between the desks is really you know, something. And as the program, I like to serve very informally in terms of Paul's original development of the curriculum and that kind of thing. He was an advanced idea about him. I knew the medical system. I knew Yale really well. And I knew kind of the philosophy here. And so where I could, I kind of helped him with the kind of the community organization to the View Medical Center. When the Soviets arrived, they pretty well helped Paul get things started and off the ground. And of course, consistently, I've been involved in admissions. And I think I've had some effect in shaping the kind of applicant we take. It has been of great interest to me. Something of a wonder. We have not had one single case of voluntary attrition. We have had one health dropout. We have had several people who have had conditions for academic reasons and one for attitude reasons. No one in almost 6 years in this program has dropped out of their own attrition, which I think is a tribute to something. I think it's not a tribute to them and not our admissions process, although maybe that's not entirely true.
Well, that combination of both.
So they've been involved in the admissions process. Those early days of admissions were really something. All anybody ever got was a committee interview plus the interview with medical school faculty.
Wasn't like it was when I came.
No.
It was organized.
No.
Scheduled.
And then of course I taught the, what's really the psychology course and then the interviewing course. That's really in terms of the my role in the MBA program has really been, you know, really reasonably limited. When I was always listed on the, stationery being part of this, the faculty and staff, and that's been just a quirk in the last couple of years, because when I really was taken on by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as a senior program consultant, more or less a consultant for them, mid-level health workers, nurse practitioners, and PA, it really struck me that it was probably a matter of conflict of interest to be identified as being on the administration of a PA program. And indeed, my appointment is in the Department of Surgery, and my funding comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And I'm just a faculty member that Paul can call on to teach and to do help with the admission.
Mm-hmm.
But Bob Levine imposed on me to keep my name on the stationery. But that's less accurate than it appears.
Mm-hmm.
And people have wondered, you know, about my efforts on behalf of nurse practitioners with the foundation. And of course, I have to have some interest in the nurse practitioners and in forging a nursing strategy for the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Does not mean that in any way I have abandoned the position of associateship. It's just that they pay my salary and obligation. Obey my marching orders. But I think one of the things that the physician's associate program here does is give me a window on the physician's assistant in terms of their clinical expertise and it's a standard against which I hold nursing programs. And I'll tell you, we have funded very few nursing programs, because very few of them come up to that standard. And I never quarrel with who's going to do this primary care, but I have a great conviction about what it takes to do it, because I know what it takes to be a clinician. That's my role. It's a very important kind of role.
Yeah,
it pretty much covers the whole thing. You know, you really have several levels of things here. You have the history of the physician's associate program here at Yale, its present interface with the School of Medicine, School of Nursing, and the University as a whole, its future interface, which is pretty much an open question, its impact nationally, the Yale program nationally, and the backwards feedback to the UPA program that will result from the national funding resolution for that. It's one thing I think that one can say hubris or pride is that Yale's program is probably one of the best in the country. It's held as a standard against which other PA programs are measured. One of the things you might want to ask Paul or Fred about when you get a chance to interview them is what was the story on the decision not to apply for AMA accreditation? You know, we only were accredited last year.
Yeah.
That was a decision which was a real...
Well, I thought it was AMA...
AMA approved. We decided very early, we were invited to submit our application for approval, and we declined. And I'll tell you, that is a case of real brass gonads as far as I'm concerned, but there was a story to that that I really just don't quite know what that was all about, but I don't know the reason Dan Beard tell you anymore. But what the reason was. But it sure didn't hurt us, and it sure didn't hurt Sadler's or Paul.
Yeah.
But that would be about the only other thing, the history of the accreditation of the program.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's
very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.